The Helicancer Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicancerJane.com. Welcome to the Helicancer Jane Show. I am your host, Helicancer Jane. Boy, what a show we have for you today. In our first segment, the author of an important new book, Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All, Stephen Dynan. Think our partisan politics have gotten out of hand? You betcha. Stephen offers up solutions to the gridlock and more. It's a fascinating conversation, promise. And after our break, they're back. Our saucy, sassy, smart panel, four broads talking, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and whatever, Sheila Weller, Lisa DiPaolo, Lisa Schifrin, and me, bringing up the rear. So stay tuned. But before we begin, the Helicancer Jane Show is brought to you by our new partner, our favorite store, the finest in offering gourmet foods, Dean and DeLuca. And remember, the Helicancer Jane Show is always available online at HelicancerJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, SoundCloud, the iHeartRadio Network, Blog Talk Radio, and at our newest home on Google Play Music. Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All, with a foreword by Marianne Williamson. Stephen Dynan, noted social entrepreneur and visionary political strategist, CEO of the Shift Network, member of the prestigious Transformational Leadership Council, the Evolutionary Leaders Group, the Stanford graduate who also directed and helped to create the Esalen Institute's Center for Theory and Research, analyzes America's internal political conflicts, opting for a transpartisan movement that will transcend our damaging polarities and will hold to a vision that honors the ideals of both the left and the right, forwarding an evolution that is both political and spiritual. Wishful thinking? Can America evolve into a transpartisan way of thinking? Let's talk. Stephen, talk to me about this. If Sacred America, Sacred World is one thing, it's hopeful. There is no question that politically and in many other ways, these are trying times for America. You appear to be an optimistic soul. Is that true about you? Let's begin at the end.
I absolutely am, but I think that optimism is also realism, because the truth is that if you look at our 240 years of history, is that we have overcome all of kinds of major challenges. I mean, we've gotten to the level where we've had a full-scale civil war that killed hundreds of thousands of people, and even millions of people. And, you know, that's what it ultimately took to get beyond slavery. So, you know, we've faced greater obstacles in our history, but it's just like when we get to a certain stage, the problems start to accumulate, and they can feel really overwhelming at the time. But America ultimately is very optimistic, solution-oriented, forward-looking, and we do find our way through. Sometimes it just takes us a while to get there.
Okay, so this is a book about getting there. So let's talk a little bit. But before we do, let's talk about you. Tell everybody who you've had a remarkable evolution of your own. Talk to me from the beginning to where you are today. Give us kind of an overview of who Stephen Dynan is.
Well, I grew up in northern Minnesota, and so I got some of that good earthy Midwest roots. And then I came to California, where I got more into the experimental leading edge of culture, which is part of California's specialty. I went to Stanford, and it was more in the science field, and ultimately realized that I was more intrigued with the frontiers of consciousness in psychology and spirituality and new thinking. And so I went and got a degree in East-West psychology, and that led me to all sorts of different spiritual practices and transformational programs, and eventually working for the Esalen Institute. And then I got a big download in a meditation retreat that I needed to create this global media company that was going to be bringing forth education and training and seminars and media and eventually local hubs to help shift the world. And at the time, I had no business background and frankly, no business creating a business. business, but I took the inner guidance and I went for it. Failed a couple times, but eventually got it off the ground. And now we have a global company that's touched, you know, almost 1 million people around the world, and, you know, has 50 team members that are serving up really deep transformational content. So, you know, I've learned to trust this kind of inner knowing that about what needs to happen next, even when it seems a bit like it doesn't, like this year I had a lot on my plate, and to try to get this book done and out for this particular time, Sacred America, Sacred World, is just like a bit of a heavy lift. But, you know, I got the strong sense it was important. And, you know, at the time we didn't know what was going to be the ultimate shape of the race for president, but it certainly turned into one of our most contentious political seasons, and with a lot of real disenchantment and frustration. And so there's a heavy emotional energy in the air. Like every week is just like a new boxing match. And so I really feel like it's important to have a voice of hope and transformation and a pathway for how do we actually move beyond the breakdowns into a breakthrough.
I like that. Now, two things. One is, you were talking about the business. It's the Shift Network. So I want people to know that. Go online, check it out. It's fascinating. And the second thing would be this. 10 years it took you to write this thing. That's no small amount. I can't even imagine, but you did get it out. And I want to look at it from this point of view. There's a thesis here. Let's give the overall thesis, and then we'll go back and we'll kind of, you know, go down the rat holes and examine some of the things that you're suggesting here.
Great. Well, part of the principle of the Shift Network is that we're making a collective shift into a new paradigm of reality, really. And it's a global paradigm. It's one where it's really based in oneness and a sense of we're one sacred family as humanity. And rather than being based in our separate identities and religions and nations, that we're really like one human family. We have to figure out how to take care of this beautiful planet we've been given. And so that really translates into the political sphere, into what I am calling a sacred America, which is based on a sacred respect for all of life and a sacred reverence, really, for all of life. And so when we take this kind of a sacred worldview and we apply it politically, it means that we have to stop demonizing our political rivals or people who have different political perspectives and start doing what I call political cross-training, to sort of step across the aisle, see the world through the eyes of somebody else, and begin to design solutions that actually appeal on different levels. So this gets really practical when you take it down to the level of like specific policies. And I could give an example of like $15 an hour minimum wage. It's very strongly championed on the left, but it's all from a left value system. You can actually champion it from the right with a different value system and say $15 an hour minimum wage actually allows people to not be on the dole from the government. They don't need subsidies in the form of childcare and healthcare and all the other kinds of subsidies that you need if you're making $7 an hour and you can't feed yourself or your family. So you can argue for a $15 an hour minimum wage by saying this is about shrinking the size of government, reducing the tax burden, allowing people to be more, have responsibility for their own lives rather than depending on someone else. And so that's a more right-leaning argument, but it ultimately is pointing to the same direction, same destination. So this connects in with the concept of just a sacred America is one where we have the deepest respect for other people and other political positions, and that we see that there's a complementarity in the evolution of the whole. So we're not simply trying to vanquish or defeat or stop the opposition necessarily. We're trying to find those bridge points where the policies, the perspectives that we're advocating can actually find traction with different political orientations, and therefore become stronger and be better solutions for the larger whole.
All right, let me break in here then, because there is something that I want to discuss with you in terms of all of this. You know, we all have our own opinions on how and why our politics have disintegrated. I think we have to look at that a little bit. I mean, who struck John first? That game has become almost what a national pastime, a parlor game, if you will. I pledge allegiance to my party rather than the U.S. That would be how I see it. But, yeah. But this disunity, I think as you do, has its roots in something far more serious than just ideological squabbles. And it almost reflects a breakdown, a spiritual component to that breakdown of our nation. Doesn't it reflect what? The breakdown of our families, the breakdown of our moral compass, a breakdown in an understanding of just a basic part of the core of our republic, e pluribus unum. I mean, it seems to me there's a breakdown of something here. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of different levels, and you point to some of them. I think one of the deepest is that we're seeing this year is actually part of a breakthrough. So to kind of connect the breakdown and the breakthrough is that what we most need right now is to rebalance our political culture in the masculine and feminine qualities. in many ways. We've had a political culture that has been based upon a very masculine model for a long time, which is very, very combat oriented, very competition oriented, and not as focused on the collaborative bridge building that women tend to be better at. And so we actually need some of both. We need the healthy individual. We need the masculine, the strength and the power of that. We need more of the weaving together of different people that women tend to be better at. And so we had in our founding, we had a couple things in our founding. First of all, we were founded on a violent revolution against Britain, which probably didn't need to happen. We probably could have had, like Canada, eventually a nonviolent separation or individuation that didn't sort of lead us to glorify violence as the way to create change. And we didn't have, we could have had eventually, you know, women weren't even enfranchised to vote until 1920. So you basically have a political culture that's like hyper-masculine. And then it becomes too wedded to violent means as a way to create change. And that leads people to get more and more entrenched over time. And so what we're seeing now is actually with Hillary coming in as a woman, first major political candidate, and Donald Trump is sort of almost an exaggerated version of the alpha masculine. You know, and I say that without denigrating him, is it like he's a tough guy, doesn't care what people think of him. He's willing to, you know, say whatever he thinks. He's a warrior in many ways. And so you have a little bit of you have a kind of an archetypal playing out of certain dynamics of like the masculine at war with the feminine. And that's part of what's actually needing to shift in our psyche, where both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party need to become more balanced in how we engage politics. And to do so in a way that creates more space for more feminine qualities. I've supported a number of women, including Marianne Williamson, who have run for office. And oftentimes it's particularly hard because they feel like the number of energetic hits they take to their system is really tough. It takes a long time to kind of get it out. It's essentially like a war culture in politics. And so men are kind of have a more, you know, I guess, history with battle. And so it can somehow take that more. But it ends up sort of creating a culture that isn't whole. Ultimately, what we need is to have the sacred masculine, sacred feminine in deep partnership and deep loving relationship for a whole culture. And so while the feminine is being so marginalized, it's very difficult to create that in the culture. So there needs to be more of a bringing in the feminine impulse, as well as more women into politics. And that's part of the balancing and part of why we see such dramatic, titanic forces unleashed this year. And a lot of it's subconscious. People don't necessarily think
But
a lot of it's a subconscious thing.
But there's just to stay on the subject for another minute or so, there is something interesting here, because there are a lot of women who are anti-women, which I have yet to be able to wrap my brain around. I don't understand it. Maybe they don't want to give up or gain their power. Maybe they like it the way they are. Some of the arguments that you hear, the higher power in all of this certainly is laughing at all of this. Could there be more ironic people running as the male and the female than this? You really have to giggle about it. I mean, it's just absolutely bizarre, to say the least. But let's take that out even further than that, because I think this is there's just so much important stuff here, and never going to be enough time to discuss it all, but I'm going to do my damnedest to get as far as we can into it. We were talking about all of these aspects that are going to change or are in the process of changing. And I said to you, you know, that people get it. But, you know, the ones who get it the most are the politicians themselves. And this is something that I would like to explore. And that is, they get it. They understand the games that they're playing. And yet they foment the negative rather than the positive.
Mm-hmm.
I want to address that, because I think that a lot of people don't realize how much the politicians play us in all of this, and that we have a role in stopping that. And I know you think that, too. Talk to me.
Well, I think that it's important for us to build relationships with our political leaders. And that can happen in a lot of different ways, precisely so that we can encourage them to be more real, to be more authentic, and actually to do what they feel is the right thing. Political leaders are under titanic forces at all time. They have massive amounts of lobbying. They have to spend 4 hours a day on average. Our Congress has spent 4 hours a day fundraising. They would love to not have to spend 4 hours a day fundraising, but they need a grassroots movement to give them cover to basically make the call to get the money out of politics with a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. So there's a way in which we need to be engaged as citizens, as partners with them, and not simply just critique them in different ways. Because I think think, you know, if we're really honest, it's like generally political leaders are making a lot less money than they could in the private sector, most of them. And they are having to work extremely hard, and they're often vilified more than almost any other position. And so they're in this titanic forces pressing on them. And there's also incredible pressure to maintain the party loyalty, because the party apparatus is what's necessary to do battle and keep the position that you're in, and therefore influence more. So I think that we have to start by shifting, first of all, our attitude towards political leaders, even ones that we don't necessarily agree with. I'll give an example from my own life. I really couldn't stand Sarah Palin in 2008. She just drove me bonkers. and so instead of just rehearsing that, though, I took the time to read both of her books. And at the end of that journey, I've really started to understand who she is, her worldview, her family life, and see different things that she's done that have been admirable. And I kind of developed a kind of a fondness for her in certain ways. And at the end of that journey, I had a dream in which we were very sweet to each other and actually hugged in the dream. So it was sort of like an internal shift that I had. And then I turned it into a more of a political statement by writing an article on Huffington Post called Dissolving the Palin Prejudice. And I ended up getting a huge amount of fan mail from people on the right in particular, and a lot of people on the left are like, what are you, crazy man?
Yeah, right.
But what it did for me is it actually opened the door to deeper kinds of connections and respect with conservatives, and it led to being able to, I think, ultimately be a better business person, be a better political strategist, be a better change catalyst in our society, because ultimately to have change endure, you need to have both conservative and progressive forces on board. It's not simply a war that one is going to, because it always, there's backlash later, and then you get undermined on this level. So you want both sides to evolve to the next level, and that means building relationships and connections.
Aaron, you're talking attitude adjustment, and I think that's a fair conversation to have for a lot of different reasons. You know, one of the things that I was saying to a friend the other day was that if you watch the dialogue just on Facebook between the opposing sides, it goes beyond ideology. It is hateful. It is cruel. There is something in the psyche of Americans today that goes, you know, they talk about everybody's angry, you know, I don't have my fair share, I this, that. I think it's more than that. I think that we have to recognize that there is something very hateful in it that's got a seed in the heart of a lot of Americans today. It's a win-lose. There is no in-between. I will take out my frustration on the other, mm-hmm. rather than listen to the other or try and compromise with the other or try to find a different way. Do you sense any of that, or is that just...
I think you're right on. And, you know, the internet is an amplifier of those tendencies because it allows us to do...
To get away with it, yeah.
Get away with it allows our id to come out without repercussions.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so I think that's where it's really important that we do this very personal work of bridge building and modeling that for others. You know, when I shared that article in Huffington Post, I shared that with friends, family, and allies. I put it in the book as well. And it's like that, you know, might impact 10,000 people or more, you know, at least start to question, you know, maybe they really couldn't stand Sarah Palin, but is that something they want to stay stuck in, or is it something that they want to transform? And when you at least plant the seed that when we're in a state of hate and polarization, it ultimately not only is toxic and doesn't feel good for ourselves, it does a number of things. It undermines our ability to find truly creative solutions that do work for more people, and that there are a lot of ways that left and right can bridge and create better solutions. And it also, on a subtler level, spiritually, it separates us from part of ourselves. Because there is a great mystical truth of oneness that we are all interconnected on a deep level, and modern science is starting to demonstrate that in different ways too. So when we're busy warring with someone else who's a part of reality, which is ultimately a part of ourselves, we're separating off from part of our deepest identity. We're actually separating off from the energy of love and connection and generosity. We're separating from that which gives our life the most meaning and value. So it's not fun, and it's not effective, and it doesn't get better results. It's basically like an old addiction that we need to let go of. Now, I don't think that just by my saying that overnight, people are going to let go of it. But if those of us who are on a path of growth, of personal growth and consciousness, really take it on as a practice, that we're trying to get beyond our political polarization and to really embrace people of different persuasion, you know, that's really important, because it ultimately heals the schisms in the human heart and reunites the human family. And whereas it used to be more acceptable to do that along racial lines, there's still a certain amount of that. It's still somewhat acceptable, socially acceptable, to be filled with hatred and discrimination and real disgust based purely on political lines. And that's what needs to shift. We need to actually eventually see that the maybe you call it politicism is ultimately as harmful to us as racism.
Well, you know, I was going to say this to you, that I'm in business of listening. You know, that's what I do. It astonishes me how few people actually listen. Most people just want to be right and talk and get their point of view out. I think that's another thing that's really hurting this country, is I think a lot of people don't listen to one another. You know, they want to prove something. Maybe there's a massive insecurity in the psyche of America today that's fueling a lot of this. But it's a point that I think has to be made. It's something that I see all the time. And it truly, as I said, astonishes me how few people are willing to listen.
But let me
please
speak to that.
Absolutely.
A second, because it connects to what I was saying before, where when you have essentially a martial or wartime political culture, showing signs of vulnerability becomes dangerous. And so our psyche doesn't want to put us in danger. So what people will do is express their opinion, because being more aggressive with our opinion is less vulnerable than really letting somebody else in. So you actually have to shift a conversation out of that kind of more aggressive posturing. And one way to do that is to drop into, like, what's the real source of people's values? Where you know, how did they grow up? Let's say they're talking about guns. Who was the first person who taught you about guns? And what did you learn about them? And how did you grow to relate to them in a responsible way? We can ask questions that actually elicit a deeper level of personal story that is part of where bridges happen. You know, these living room conversations that Joan Blades and a number of other people like Devlin Molyneux have been activating as transpartisan bridge building, they start with the personal backstory. Because if you start with the current position, they tend to be really frozen and increasingly polarized, and people are fearful. Subconsciously fearful that if they show signs of weakness, they're going to be bullied or overpowered in different ways. And so that makes it hard to listen. So you have to kind of drop the guard, get into people's deeper personal stories, open up a real human connection. And then you can kind of like gently explore into the edges of things, and people can listen to each other more deeply. But it's like you have to shift the dynamic first, because it makes sense. So, you know, if you're under siege, you don't want to show your underbelly.
In what you say, there's judgment and there's defensiveness that are also very active amongst Americans these days that I don't recall when I was younger seeing. In fact, I saw the opposite, and I'm sure you did too. We grew up in a time, you know, that was very different than the one that we find ourselves in today, where, you know, peace and love and understanding were something that we all kind of got. And that's kind of fallen by the wayside a little bit to this other meme that I find very unsettling. How's
yeah.
that unsettling?
Yeah. I think it's deeper. I mean, we can get caught up in any particular electoral cycle, and maybe we're, you know, Hillary haters or Trump haters or whatever it is this cycle. But it's a deeper problem, because in 1960, parents were polled and asked, how concerned would you be if your child were to marry somebody of the opposite political party? And only 5% would have been genuinely concerned about that. And by 2010, that was closer to 50%. So people like genuinely concerned. If you're a Democrat, you really don't want your kid to marry a Republican. Like that's pretty serious level of polarization. And it's down to a level that really creating destruction in our society and really undermining our creative potential. So we have to address this in a deep way. It has to begin individually, it has to begin with communities, and ultimately has to play out on a national scale. So one thing that I've been talking about with some allies is, what about if we did 10 days after the election, we had a national day of reconciliation? We had Republican and Democratic leaders basically come together in clearing and you know, bonding exercises. And then you have that at the local level, where people create living room conversations and forums, where the goal is really to just release the resentments, the grudges, the warfare psychology of the electoral process, and to really say, you know what, we are all Americans. We're all committed to creating a better country. Let's let go of some of the nastiness and now get on with like creating real solutions that work for all. Because otherwise people stay in that heightened, vigilant, fight or flight kind of state. And everything, you know, when Obama was elected, Mitch McConnell said their main objective was to simply block, a second term for Obama. It's like for 4 years, it's like they didn't want to do anything, because it was just like that was going to give potentially more leverage to the opposition. And so everything becomes caught up in this this essentially war for power.
Leadership. I think we have to talk leadership very briefly here, because it seems to me that the quality of leadership may not be what it used to be for various and sundry reasons. But if we're following a Mitch McConnell kind of leadership, you can understand how we get where we get. What kind of talk is that from a leader?
You know, I'm not sure that we've actually had a decline in the caliber of leadership. But I think what we have had, as what does happen, is the worse the political culture gets, the less likely the really high-minded, noble, selfless leaders are more wary of getting into it. So we have to take it upon ourselves to create a more enticing political environment for the best caliber leaders to step into, and to also encourage the best people that we know to run for office. It may not be for Congress, but it could be for local school board. It could be for the local city council, because it doesn't just happen at the national level. It's really from the grassroots up. So the more conscious, awake, caring people that there are in office at every level, really that starts to shift the system. And also to be aware of our tendency to just belittle politicians, like write them off, like, oh, politicians are all crooked. Who wants to join a profession where, you know, most people are saying politicians are all crooked? It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And in fact, you know, from a consciousness perspective and principle, merely by saying that, we're contributing to the decline of that population, because we're helping to invoke and attract in people who are going to be less conscious. So we actually want to heighten the attractiveness, heighten the allure, and by actually being more celebrating what's good about politicians.
Well, I think that's a good thing, but I also think that we have to also understand that they are not all good. And there happens to be a pretty poor crop among some of them these days that are fueling this kind of hatred and what have you that we've just been talking about. And to deny that that's true would be silly, too, because I think we have to be very real about how we approach it. A remark like that by the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, that will always makes me ill. It makes me ill. That's an elected official speaking that way. That's not the good of America. That's the good of his party, which is what we said in the very beginning of this conversation. I pledge allegiance to my party, not to the United States of America. So I'm not going to let him get away with that, or anybody else who speaks, officially on that level.
I agree. It's just walking this line between calling out things that need to be called out with also maintaining a loving respect.
Yes, absolutely.
Because as soon as we lose the loving respect, it tends to, the schisms get a little wider, and it tends to get nastier, and tends to get, there's less and less listening and less collaborative bridge building. And so right now I would err on the side of, you know, we can just say that's not a helpful thing to really create with the government, versus to create a government that works for the people, to really have that. And we can state our opinions on things and our discernment without demonizing the people who hold it, because, you know, ultimately we do need to kind of come back together as one American citizen, group of American citizens, rather than two parties that are putting party interests over the people.
Let me throw this at to you. You know about No Labels, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Terrific group. I got involved with them at the very early beginning of their thing. But there is one thing that I did notice, which is, and this is something that I want to talk about, that we have to be careful also, because if you want to be nonpartisan, or we're going to get into transpartisanship in a second, but if you want to have these conversations, you have to do more than just politely have them, which is something that I saw going on. Everybody was still stuck in their positions. They were just being nice about how they presented it, rather than, again, listening and coming up with something different. And that's where I think I want to bring in, you talked about transpartisan before, but let's really get into your concept here of transpartisanship.
Yeah, well, transpartisan is not really my concept, but it's something that has evolved from a whole number of people over time. And partisan is a movement that was created long before me. I didn't coin the term. And really, it's like trans means beyond partisanship, and doesn't mean to be nonpartisan. I think that's an important distinction, because people do have their opinions, and they can get a little stuck in their opinions. A transpartisan perspective is that we need to spend time going beyond our partisan positions and find a kind of a higher common ground. And when we do that, it can develop more curiosity, and there can be a more of a sense of real mutual learning from different perspectives. I like to think of this as political cross-training. So in physical cross-training, you say you want to be a great football player, you might take ballet classes, because the ballet is going to teach you different levels of coordination than the football is, and it's going to make you a better football player. So you can still be a progressive and then learn from from, in a very political cross-training way, a conservative, to see the world differently and maybe value certain things in a different way. I personally have grown a lot from different connections with conservatives, and I feel like it's made me a better leader, it's made me a better CEO, and it's made me a better veteran in politics. And so that's a sort of another level beyond just sort of grudgingly or you know, even just trying to play nice and get along, but saying, you know what, I'm curious about how to see the world from a different lens. And I know that when I do that, I'm going to be able to take another perspective, and that's going to be ultimately additive to my ability to create the changes that I want to see, because I can speak a different language. It's like if you travel in, if you have a travel abroad program and you go and study in France, you learn to see the world through a French lens, and you learn some of the French language. And so that allows you to have a richer perspective on life. And the same thing, I think, applies to politics, because they're whole different cultures. So as an example, when I wrote this book, I really wanted to get some conservatives on board and endorse it and also build bridges. And one of the people I reached out to was a guy named Rich Toffel, who is a remarkable, deep-thinking guy who's one of the founders of the Log Cabin Republicans, an early champion for gay marriage, and that he basically brought that forward within the Republican Party. Really, really lovely guy. And he read the book. He liked a lot of it. And he had some strong critiques of how I was portraying conservatives positions. And I got him on the phone, and I really listened to him, and I learned from him, and I deepened my understanding of how to see the world from a conservative perspective. And I made shifts to the book, and he actually came on as an endorser, and we're looking at potentially doing some events together in the future. So I had to sort of say, you know what, I have something to learn from you, not simply just to try to defeat you in an argument, but to say, I have something to learn from you, and your perspective is going to be additive if I can really understand it.
You take it actually even further than that, which I love in the book, and you talk about the fact they complement each other.
Right. And I think it makes sense when you come back to the human body. If you look at the human body is very conservative in certain ways, because, you know, we can die very quickly if our electrolytes go out of balance, or our pH goes out of balance, or if we run out of oxygen. There's a lot of what are called homeostatic forces in the body that keep things the same, because too much change in body systems can lead us to die fairly quickly. And so nature can be quite conservative in certain ways, but it also is always oriented towards growth. And so there's this sort of two tugs in any living organism between preserving the systems that are necessary for life and the growth into new direction and new possibility. And so just same thing in a political culture, we might temperamentally be more progressive by nature, or temperamentally more conservative by nature, and yet we're actually playing different functions in the larger whole. So for America to truly evolve into our highest potential, there's a lot that we need to conserve and preserve. And there's a lot of good in what we've done in our institutions and our founding codes and the Constitution and our laws. And so there's a lot we need to preserve about our society without changing it willy-nilly. And there's a guy that I worked with one time who he had a great way of saying it. He says, you know, I feel like progressives are always trying to change things, and my job is to slow them down.
I've heard that.
and it was a perfectly simple way to look at it, where sometimes the progressive impulse to change things really quickly and make demands and do in this direction, it's not necessarily always respecting societal institutions. So to bring it back to Rich Toffel and gay marriage, here was a man who was a gay man who created the Log Cabin Republicans, recognized in order for gay people to truly advance our society, conservatives needed to embrace them as well, because they were holding more of the homeostasis for the culture. And so, and then he said, let's embrace gay marriage, which at the time on the left was totally ridiculed. And most gay people were like, you got to be kidding. That's a totally outdated, old school conservative notion. Why would we want to have gay marriage? Like in the 90s, that's how most people reacted. But he recognized that in order for gay people to be fully integrated in the culture, it needed to be embedded in the traditional institutions like marriage. And so ultimately we've come to that same conclusion as a whole culture now. If you think about it, part of why conservatives are often more successful in business is the bigger a business you grow, the more of your attention has to go to preserving the good of what you've already created. It's harder and harder to be innovative and nimble and change things really quickly the bigger of an institution is. So you have to devote more of your attention to really stabilizing the whole company. And so you become a little more, a little less change averse or a little more change averse. I've even seen this with myself as we've grown from a startup where I was just like a visionary guy at my computer trying to convince people to do something to now having 50 or so team members. There are ways that I've had to become more conservative financially. There's different things in terms of not putting all my bets on one direction or another. I've had to learn from conservative folks how to better steward a mid-level organization. And I think that that's temperamentally, it's kind of grown me in certain ways. Even while I still am a strong believer in evolution and change and progress, it's like there's also a deeper respect for the discipline, the financial responsibility, the sort of erring on the side of caution when required that it takes to manage more sort of larger entities. And so that's part of how I think when we go beyond even just tolerating each other to learning from each other, that's how we can grow into more well-rounded and ultimately more whole citizens.
You know, the title of the book, Sacred America, Sacred World. I want to talk about that word sacred. And the reason that I want to bring it up is you're a West Coast kind of guy. I'm an East guy. I've lived on the West Coast for a long time. I know the drill, live the drill. I get it. But, you know, the people on the East Coast, where I am now, they don't always get that. It's a word that can do funny things to people. And you know, they start thinking kumbaya and maybe we shouldn't. This is garbage. This is, oh, you know, hocus pocus. This is, you know, I got to play devil's advocate here because I want to bring that up and I want to hear what you have to say about that. Speak to the suspicious ones.
I love your honesty. That's great. Well, I mean, I don't mean anything hocus pocus about it. Basically, we all hold something as sacred. We hold, for a lot of religious people, we hold our religion as sacred. We hold our, you might hold Jesus as sacred. You might hold tradition as sacred or family as sacred. Sacred is actually more about our relationship with other things rather than a set of beliefs or it's even a scientist holds the truth as sacred or the scientific method is sort of sacred. We all have our sacred cows, if you will. The reason I got the sense to call it Sacred America, Sacred World is there's two levels to that. One is we need to create an America that's based on a sacred worldview where we really see the sacred in all things. So we honor and respect the right of everything to exist on this planet and to have its role. And then there's also this relating to something in a sacred way. There's a level of reverence, of love, of respect and honor that I think we need to have in relationship to our country in order for us to grow still further. It's not about being stuck in the past, but about if you're raising a child, you really want that child to feel loved so that when you sometimes need to take corrective action or disciplinary action, that they're going to respond well to that because they know on a deep level they're totally loved. And so relating to Sacred America is, first of all, to say that when we relate to America in a more sacred way, we relate to it with more love, with more respect, with really seeing that there's a deeper intent in our country and ultimately a higher mission. Because there's something that's ultimately unsatisfying. If all we think about is that America is really just an excuse to make more money and have more stuff and create a nice life for ourselves while the rest of the world goes to hell in a handbasket, that ultimately isn't a very empowering story that we're telling ourselves. And so if we look at the founding of America, there's a lot of very deep spiritual and philosophical codes that were embedded into who we are. It's like there's a reason why there's a floating eye on the pyramid. There's a reason why it says e pluribus unum, out of many one. There's a reason why we said that we're going to create a more perfect union, not a more perfect nation. There's a lot of deep philosophical and even metaphysical principles that were built into the code of this country, not because it was supposed to be religious per se, but because there was always a sense of like there's a higher mission that's unfolding through our country. So personally, I'm very ecumenical. I grew up Christian. I've had Hindu spiritual teachers. I've practiced Buddhist meditation. I've trained with Aikido senseis. I've done Western psychology. I love Sufi poets and I've studied Kabbalah. It's like I'm very ecumenical in my stance. And I think that ultimately that's what we're moving into is a real global sense of spirituality where all the different wisdom traditions are honored. And so for me, sacred is the one term that speaks to a kind of a relating to each other and reality that is coming from, that has heart and depth and meaning, but that doesn't mean we're coming from one single lineage. You can have a sacred relationship with all of life. It's Native Americans tend to relate to all of creation in a very sacred way. So we keep extending the orbit of what we consider sacred and to relate to it in a way that really helps it evolve. That's ultimately, it's a love relationship ultimately.
I thought we should clear that up because I do know that, it's a word that can send people off, some people off, but I think it was very well used in this book. And I'm also glad that you brought the spiritual in within that answer because I was going to go there next. But here's my next thing, evolution versus revolution. I think that's such a powerful thing.
It's something that once you're sensitized to it, then you can see why it's so important. Like, I think, for instance, Bernie Sanders, his campaign, there's a lot. I was an early supporter and was actually a fan of the campaign through much of it. But I think in the last month or two, it started to get too caught up in its own revolutionary righteousness and start to actually create unnecessary polarization and disenchantment and potentially undermine people, future voters, youth voters. There's a way in which the revolutionary energy can be too self-righteous. There's not as much listening in it. It can turn violent because we're the one people with the answers. We're going to overthrow these oppressors. We're going to overthrow them. There's not a lot of respect for the dignity of the other in a revolution. And so, we kind of got caught up in glorifying revolution with the American Revolution, and we built in a little too much violence in how we create change. And so really, revolution is not what's required right now. What is really required is an evolution. It's a sense that, yes, we have some breakdowns, we have problems, we have shadow issues, we have some corruption, and they're handleable. We can evolve to the next level of health and prosperity and security and sustainability and peace. We can do this, and we have demonstrated we can do it in the past. And we don't need to, string some people up and persecute them for it. It's more like we just need to work together. And we need to work together, not just in one party, but across all lines. So that's why I call it an American evolution, because it's not about Democrats versus Republicans. It's about an American evolution where people are recognized and it's time to upgrade the operating system. It's time to go to the next level. And we're going to do so in a way of respecting that everybody can be part of the same team, even if we have very different political orientations. So the way I'm seeing it is if we create more and more of an idea of like we're creating an American evolution and we're all evolutionaries rather than revolutionaries, then we're more patient. We're working to build more bridges. We're building more alliances rather than simply just pushing our opinion down other people's throats. And we can also create that sense of like, this is a big tent that can include everybody. You can be an evolutionary Republican. You can be an evolutionary Democrat. You can be an evolutionary Green. It doesn't really matter what your political orientation is. It's more just saying, you know what, we have this higher unity that we are working towards and that we have a superordinate goal that we're all working towards, which is to evolve America to the next level of health and high happiness and prosperity.
I've been speaking with Stephen Dynan, author of Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission and Service to All, with a foreword by Marianne Williamson, by way of Hampton Roads Publishing. For more information, visit Stephen's websites at sacredamerica.net and theshiftnetwork.com. You are listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. My guest today, Stephen Dynan, author of Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All. And our panel, four broads talking, including Sheila Weller, Lisa DePaula, Lisa Schifrin, and me. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. Okay, folks, they're back. Here's our second episode of Four Broads Talking. In case you don't remember from last week, our ladies, or broads, we go both ways, are Sheila Weller, Lisa DePaula, Lisa Schifrin, and me, Hallie Kasser Jane. I'll be joining in as well as moderating. Okay, here we go. We're four broads talking. So, okay, ladies, before we start, I want to say hi to my four. What are we calling ourselves? I'm so
four broads talking.
Four broads talking. Thank you very much. But I want to introduce.
You're one of the four.
I am one of the four. But I want to introduce the rest of you so everybody gets to know your voices, who you are. Let me start with Sheila Willa. Hi, Sheila. Tell me something about
Hi,
you.
Hi, Hallie.
Hi, sweetie.
Okay, I'm a writer. I write about women. I write about social issues. I write for Vanity Fair, lots of other magazines, Girls Like Us, The New Sorority. I'm a liberal, but very un-PC about certain things, from the obsession with transgenderism to national security. I'm kind of not a liberal about some things. So kind of think for myself.
To Paulo, Lisa, we're going to call you Lisa D, if I can remember to do that, because we have two Lisas. Talk to me about you, Miss Lisa.
I've been a magazine writer for, oh, gosh, did I just get bleeped?
You did, but that's okay.
And, wow, it's been 35 years. And what else? I write about all kinds of stuff, politics, celebrities, true crime when I'm really lucky if it's politics and true crime in the same story. And I have a son. He's a Havanese. His name is Joey Obama. And that's because he has one black ear and one white ear. And just a little aside, when I told Vice President Biden that his name was Joey Obama, he said, "That's so sweet. You named him for both of us."
That's great.
I said,
All right. So Lisa Schifrin, who is our resident Republican, probably has something to say about that. Hi, Lisa. Tell us about you.
Hi, Hallie. Well, I guess I'm the resident conservative. Sometimes I will surprise you, but not that often. I'll surprise myself as I surprise you. So I have three teenage daughters. Been home taken care of for the last many years. I started off as a newspaper editorial writer, and then became a political reporter, and then a war correspondent overseas in Afghanistan and Pakistan in the late 1980s when the Russians were there, the Soviets. Then I worked for a while at the Defense Department, doing things I can't tell you about, in a new office then devoted to kind of the small wars, counterterrorism, and that sort of thing that we knew was coming, but we didn't know that it would come as big as it's come. I mean, everybody understood at the end of the 80s that the post-Cold War world would not be like the Cold War world. But
hey, Schifrin, I'm going to interrupt you because you're doing what conservatives always do, yakety yak.
Sorry.
So we're going to finish it up. Finish it up, darling.
I write for the New York Observer, and I do a lot of ghostwriting for other people.
Okay. Nice to have all of you here as part of the Four Broads. I'm the fourth, of course, and I think I'm not going to tell you anything about me as if any of you don't know anything about me.
We know that you.
So we'll just get going with what we're here to talk about today. And so here we go. All right. So, you know, my Republican friend, I'm going to start with you. Okay?
Sure.
All right. So here we go, because you know what happened today as we go into recording this story. Hillary has been cleared of all charges by the FBI, although the director, James Comey, did call Clinton and her aides, quote unquote, careless. So, my friend Lisa S., what you got to say about that?
Well, I would not have used the phrase cleared of all charges. I would have said what he said. He recommended against charging her and trying her as a criminal. What he did in his TV report, his broadcasted report, I heard it on the radio, was to list, it was actually an astonishing performance because he listed for roughly 12 of the 13 minutes all of the lies she has told, all of the places where her negligence, and I would say gross negligence, since she was the Secretary of State and understood that she was dealing in highly classified information, all of the places where she had lied about not doing that on her private server, she did it a bunch of times. He said at some point not only that they were extremely careless, but that her system was less secure than Google. And then he went on to say that hostile actors gained access to the private email accounts of people Hillary corresponded with, and therefore we understand hers.
So we get all of this. We get this. You don't have to go into it. Wait a minute.
She's not being charged. That doesn't mean that she has not demonstrated terrible judgment, gross negligence, and really,
All right, DePaulo, hold it. And everybody, all of you have to listen to me. Remember, that's the rule. So, DePaulo, I'm throwing it to you. Answer.
Look, this doesn't move the needle at all. It doesn't move
Agree.
The needle. And, you know, the people who want to hear that she was cleared or whatever you want to call it are going to say yippee-yay. The people who heard it the previous 10 minutes are going to say, told you. It doesn't make a difference. I just don't want to keep hearing about it.
Well, I think it's over. Weller, talk to me.
Yeah. And are they going to go back to Benghazi? I mean, you know, the Republicans have had these couple of things. They've gone on and on and on and on. I cannot see that this was ever a big deal. And she was cleared of it. and come with something substantive about her policies, about her experience, and give me what is so dangerous about her as opposed to Donald Trump, that lovely, incredibly experienced man, incredibly even-keeled, sophisticated.
She says facetiously, Lisa asks, I'm going to say this to you, though, okay? FBI Director Comey is a very well-respected man on both sides of the aisle. So what are you saying here? Because if you say that this is a bunch of hooey, then you're really putting this guy down. He's the one who needs to go, not her. Talk to me. And make it quick.
One, Comey, I think, lost a lot of that respect today. But here's something that Comey did. He laid out the case against her, and then he said, nah, don't prosecute. He laid it out so clearly that I think he left it for the American people to judge. And perhaps that was the best he thought he could do. So the real point is, whatever you think of Donald Trump, he is clearly right. And the American people will see this regardless of what side they're on when he says that the system is rigged. Justice for the Clintons is very different than justice for any of us. Had any of us done what she did, we, like David Petraeus, would have lost our jobs. We would have lost our careers, certainly our clearances. Nobody would be promoting us to president.
Nobody, Donald Trump has done nothing wrong, like take all the money from those Trump University people, all those bankruptcies.
You know,
oh, come on, Lisa. Really? Come on.
All right. We're not going to solve this one, obviously.
No.
I think that a good point to be made here is don't worry about it, my friends on the left, because they're going to come up with something else. They're going to go after the Clinton Foundation. They're going to go because the only thing that they have and their only hope of not losing or of winning is to take Hillary down. And what, how many years, 30-something-odd years of taking Hillary down, gotten nobody really far.
Yeah.
So here we go again. Let's move on to this because I think this is this. Schiffer, I'm going to give this one too because I know that Democrats, you're concerned. The Democrats are so eager to support a candidate who is at the least so careless. That's what you said to me in our private conversation today. And they're obviously uninterested. You think that the Democrats are the worst and that Republicans, they're shining examples of accepting.
You know, like all three of you, I am old enough to remember when a bunch of Republicans resigned during the Nixon administration because they didn't want to cover up for a president who was lying.
And they were fabulous. And that vote
and
was
I see
inspiring.
Nothing like that now. I see no one acting like that in the Democratic Party.
Well, you're going to compare Watergate to Hillary putting a server in her house?
Oh, my God. I think this is so much worse.
Oh, my
really?
God.
Nobody
How?
Died in Watergate.
Why? What? I didn't hear that. What?
They said nobody died in Watergate.
Oh, come on.
Nobody died because of her server. Please, Lisa.
That is not even remotely
clear. Wait a minute. Whoa. Stop. For those who don't understand what you're referring to, died. Are you talking about Foster? What are you talking about, died?
No. I'm talking about intelligence officers. And
There's no proof, number one, that any of that is true.
You're right, Sheila. I'm going to Benghazi. Yes, I'm talking about that.
Benghazi. I brought you to Benghazi.
Okay, all right, enough. Let's get off of it because we're not going anywhere with
let's
that. Let's move on to the next thing, and I do have something to that, and that's Vice President. Let's talk about the Vice President game.
And
I'm going to give it to Sheila because I know she's been chomping at the bit on this.
Yeah, I'm jumping at the bit. I think Hillary should choose Mark Kelly as her Vice President. He was a Navy officer in combat, an astronaut, a gun control advocate, the devoted husband of Gabrielle Giffords. I think he'd be totally cool and out of the box and integrity-filled vice president, okay? And I think Donald Trump should choose Nikki Haley. I interviewed her once at the governor's mansion. I think she's very groovy. I think underneath what she says she is, and I think she's obviously a fiscal conservative, she's a social liberal. We giggled together when we looked at who's that old segregationist, I'm blocking his name now, in his christening gown. She was laughing. She had all these great women rock and rollers piped in as she was walking around in her Mario Blahniks. I think she'd be cool.
Hey, DePaulo, what do you think?
Well, I don't think Mark Kelly's a good idea, and I don't want to say why on the radio.
No.
You have to say why. You brought it up. Tell us why.
Let's doubt
that. I think that maybe perhaps many years ago, he's an astronaut, that perhaps many years ago, there may have been some bill-like issues.
Really?
They don't care about everybody's bill-like issues. They only care about Bill's bill-like issues.
No, I don't think that's true.
Nevertheless, he's not going to be the vice presidential candidate.
Haley,
so let's not go there. But go ahead, Lisa DePaulo.
Nikki Haley hates Trump's guts, but that's...
It was Trump's sermon.
But here's the thing about vice presidents. I don't think anybody ever votes. I think it's been proven in polling over the years that nobody ever voted for someone because of the vice president. Although I did vote for Mondo because of Ferraro. I think people vote against people because of the vice president, especially with talent. Lisa, you would know, did Bush, the first Bush, lose votes because of Quayle in the reelection?
No. Hey, wait, I want to tell you something that you don't know. In both of those cases, Quayle and Palin, hated by the media, hated by liberals, ridiculed, stupid.
Right.
The electorate.
Brought in more votes among the Republican base of conservatives than the principal on the ticket did.
I believe
Palin actually brought votes
did,
to
yeah.
McCain. There's no question about that, whether you like her or not or think she should have been on that ticket. She was a net vote getter.
All right, guys, don't jump in because we're going to lose the whatever, one at a time here. Okay, that's a point well taken, Lisa. What about you, DePaula? You wanted to say something?
Yeah, Lisa, you know, I was a registered Republican until McCain picked Palin. Now I can tell you why I was registered.
Yeah, do please.
Well, it was mainly for I wanted to vote for a particular local candidate once, but I also am not, you know, I'm not a crazy liberal. I'm liberal, but not crazy all the time. But no, I also, honestly, it's when I write profiles, political profiles, Republicans check.
Okay.
Democrats never check.
Wow.
Interesting.
Because they assume you're a liberal and they know they're going to get your love.
Yeah. But I kind of pride myself on the fact that I don't have an agenda when I profile someone.
That's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. Let me jump in here because I want to say this. Okay. In the case of Hillary, it'll be a nice addition. Honestly, I don't think anybody cares one way or the other. I do think it's major in Trump, and for the obvious reason, which is he's a political neophyte and he's just made everybody crazy. And so, you know, you need to have somebody with some sense of knowledge about the issues and about the real things that matter when it gets to the day of governing. So that being said, Lisa Schifrin, give us who your choice is, and then I have something to say about that.
Okay. Well, you know what? The one person whose name I've heard mentioned who I love is Tom Cotton. He's young. He's a brand new senator, but Trump needs somebody who is more conservative than he is on the issues, but also somebody in Congress, in the Senate or Congress. So Newt Gingrich makes sense. I don't know. Newt's actually brilliant in many ways, but he's also maybe somebody who we're tired of. I certainly think Christie is a bad idea because he's too much of a bull. Joni Ernst.
Talk about Joni Ernst. Yeah.
But she's also a neophyte. And, you know, she just voted wrong on some immigration issue that will be a problem for her.
You know, that's interesting about Tom Cotton, though, Lisa, because, you know, when I was in Arkansas, during the Senate race, you know, it was Trumpian in a way. You know, they all tried to put him, the Democrats tried to put him down, and the people got something about him, which has served two tours in Iraq, okay? Like on his family's fifth generation. Mm-hmm. So while I don't agree with most of his politics, there was something admirable about him as a character, and the Democrats totally missed that.
Well, he's also really smart in the traditional academic way. He's got that Harvard law degree.
Oh, right.
And you know what? Unlike Trey Gowdy, he's not a showman, but he will make a very concise, serious case when he is arguing.
I have a thing about him. I'm going to interject here, and I'm going to tell you that I find him offensive. He can be so curt and so cold and so cruel in some of the things that he says. I watched him last night, and I'm telling you, I started to break out in a sweat. I'm going, could you smile? Could you be human? Could you show us something other than just pure hate? That's one of the things that keeps coming across with a lot of these Republican conservative, the ones who are the typical. The presentation is so off-putting so much.
It's true. It's true. Most of them need
lessons and how to.
You know, I live in New York. There are drama coaches who, you know, we lined up for Ted Cruz that it never kind of got happening. That's what you need. They need
charm school.
Both speech coaches and drama coaches.
It would go a long way because I tell you personally, I mean, you know, I think I'm a fairly intelligent person and I listen. I'm a good listener. I find it tough to listen to them. I am so, they just make me want to not listen, but to become combative with them. I think that's a lot of the problem in the Republican Party right now. They're so dogmatic, so angry, so hostile, so this, that, and the other thing. That's what comes across. You can never get to listen to what ideas they may have.
As you know, they are angry. We are angry. I'm angry. People are angry for cause, for all sorts of real causes.
Well, I think Democrats have reasons to be angry, too. And, you know, and I'm an independent. I'm in the middle of all of you. I go one way or the other. What? Say what?
The whole middle class has reason to be angry.
Everybody's angry. It doesn't give you, right. It doesn't give you a reason to come off in that kind of, you know, it's demonic sometimes.
I think Ted Cruz was demonic. I don't know Tom Cotton. I haven't heard him.
Yeah, well, go listen to him. It's no different.
Scare the S out of me. And I thought Donald Trump would be better than Ted Cruz.
Right.
Because Donald Trump is a social liberal and he could be male evil. I mean, he would be embarrassing. We'd all want to leave the country. But Ted Cruz scared the bejesus out of me. And I know that you like him.
It's the opposite of what Republicans want. Republicans actually want somebody who's conservative and who will actually be effective. So,
well, I don't think they will be effective, though. That's the point.
Maybe not. But Trump has gotten pretty far being pretty angry and being pretty, you know, unpleasant.
No, he doesn't come across that way. That's where you're wrong. The reason Trump has gotten so far is because he says some things that God knows we all kind of go roll our eyes at. But he does it in such a funny, charming, goofy kind of, you know, Trumpian way that it gets by. It goes away. We all scream and carry on. But he's not, to my mind, just scary like the others come across. There's something he knows how to charm.
I think we're going to change the subject soon, but I just want to say to Lisa Schifrin, didn't Cruz's religiosity put you off a little bit? You mentioned it a couple of times because he's totally Christian. That's more important than anything else. This is a Christian country. That's what I got from Ted Cruz.
Well, I'll tell you the answer to that. Yes, I thought he did way too much of that, especially since I don't actually believe he's that kind of guy. I think he kind of pushed that hard because he had a strategy that involved the evangelical vote, which he didn't ultimately benefit much from. And I think that was a dumb mistake. And had I been advising him, I would have told him to throttle back a lot.
All right, let's change it. Let's get off that. Let's get to where I really want to go today, because there was a piece that I read yesterday. I posted this on Facebook, and we got some really interesting responses to it, and I want to hear what you guys say. I want to bring this up. It takes us back to Hillary, your favorite subject, Schifrin.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Kennedy Townsend, former congresswoman, wrote a terrific piece in the New York Times. She asked, she asked, what should a powerful woman look like? I posted, as I said, on Facebook, my gosh, ugly, hateful, vicious takedowns of all things Clinton. It was and from women.
Mm-hmm.
Women. I don't get the Sheila respond, because you know, Kathleen.
Yes, well, a lot of Republican women dislike Hillary. A lot of Republican men dislike Hillary. Clearly, we found a few months ago during the Gloria Steinem and Madeleine Albright dust-ups where they said, especially Gloria, something pretty darn innocent. I heard it, and she got pounced on. Millennial women have a thing with having Hillary pushed down at the time, pushed down their throats because she was the first woman. Hillary's got some baggage. Some people don't like Hillary. I saw some of those remarks and I was astonished. Kathleen's piece was about what should a female candidate look like. I think, with all due respect to her, and I think she's wonderful. I think Kathleen is wonderful, and she is the only female in that family that ran for office.
She said something nice. Here comes the killer. Go ahead, kid.
She's great. No. But I think when she said things like, "Well, they got mad at me because I didn't wear pantyhose one day," I don't think that's the thing anymore. I think you can get away with not wearing pantyhose. It's been chic to not wear pantyhose in the Condé Nast Building for like 15 or 20 years. But I think there's still an issue with women's attitudes, with women, in power's attitudes. I think we've got the good-looking, power-suited women executive down. It may not be a political model, maybe a Silicon Valley model, but I think the looks part is okay. They know how to get the looks part right. I think the assertive talk part is harder. I think it's easier for a guy to do that. And it'll be more accepted. It's always more accepted.
But I think her article was a fair article to because I hear so many things from so many different people on this subject. And I never hear Hillary mentioned within a few minutes. Somebody doesn't say something about the clothes she's wearing, the hair.
I
hear that all the time.
I want to surprise you here.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. By saying that I hate Hillary.
I'm not surprised.
I think she looks great. She looks exactly like Peter Right. And you know what the real key to it is? The key, ladies, is that she is a postmenopausal woman who is not, there's a word out there that I don't want to use. She is not, the first thing that you think when you look at her, she's well-groomed, she's got all her makeup's perfect, the hair, the clothes are a little weird, but, you know, they scream money and
power. Your point. That's
my point is that nobody looks at her and wants to sleep with her. That's a distraction. She's not nubile, she's not fertile, she's postmenopausal. All powerful women are. Thatcher, Gandhi.
Well, that's sad, isn't it?
It's not sad. It's not a good idea to put young people at the head of major countries. You know, I don't think we should elect people who are 40. I think we should elect people who are 55.
But I don't do it. But I have to say this to you. So if a woman who, you know, there are a lot of women who are in their 60s who are drop dead gorgeous, still sexual, still look the part. Look fantastic. What? They can't run because they're too pretty?
No. They can run, but they're not really, you know.
You're not going to buy it because a woman be a crone and have power, but she can't be an attractive crone and have power.
No, that scares me. That's not really what I'm saying.
No, that's not what she's saying.
There's really a difference between, like, there really is a split between being sexually appealing primarily and primarily radiating power. And our media culture, you know, Hollywood likes to pretend that they're the same thing. In that Madam Secretary or the Good Wife way, you know, those women go back and forth being really attractive to everyone around them and also being powerful. But that's kind of nonsense.
Well,
real women with power are
Angela Merkel,
Janet Reno.
Yeah. Men.
Look at the cabinet. None of them are hot babes. They're serious women.
Men. I don't know. Nancy Pelosi's looking pretty good, even at her age and her 50
facelift.
She's
a crone, and she has always been a crone.
She's a pretty attractive woman.
Let's not put down women's looks. But
I do think that this is an important conversation. No, but Lisa, Sheila, listen to this. Listen to how this becomes about women's looks and whether they can be this, that, or the other thing. There's still something here.
It's not looks, it's age.
Well, that's even worse.
No, it's not worse. It's,
to me, it's
something
worse.
Everybody can grow into.
To me, it's
I
worse.
I actually don't think Hillary's being busted for her looks. I think she's being busted for the emails, Benghazi, the Bill Clinton, and Monica, whatever, with the history of it. So I don't think anyone's – she used to be busted because of the headbands ages ago or the changing of the hairstyle, which was silly. I don't think she's being busted for her looks any more than anybody else in the public eye. Who isn't, you know.
I think she is being busted for being a woman.
She is.
I think that works for her way more than against her.
No.
Paula, what do you think?
Of course she is. Look, do we need any more proof that you know, everything's different for her?
Right. Absolutely. Okay. I think you can't ignore that.
But guess what? She looks fantastic. And let me tell you, to be able to pull it together that way, to look that great, which she must, because if she has an off day, she'll get crucified. You know, it's not easy. And I think it's amazing. Her stamina is off the charts. When I traveled with her to Burma, I mean, the reporters were all like dragging, dying, like sweating bullets. She was amazing. Her stamina is off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think she looks fantastic.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, it's always going to be different. Of course, it's going to be different. But I want to add, I thought there was such a beautiful moment today that no matter what you think of her, anyone or anybody who thinks anything about Barack Obama, to watch them walking off that Air Force One today.
It was nice.
Well, first of all, and to all the, you know, people, the campaign is paying for their ride on Air Force One. But to watch the first black president and the first woman nominated for president walk off that plane together, I got chills.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a nice moment.
It was.
Nice moment.
They both looked
Lisa Schifrin, you don't probably think it was such a nice moment, but it's a nice moment.
We know that.
Well, I want some of what she had to drink for lunch.
Okay.
I mean, maybe I'd get chills too watching people come.
Yeah. Well, at least Lisa DeVolo had from us. Yeah.
Me too.
Oh my God, Schifrin.
Pass it over.
All right, I'm taking control back because I have one other thing because we really are running out of time. I can't believe it, but we are. And I want to bring this up. I want to talk about Mr. Trump, some of the mistakes that he's making. You know, we lost a great one this week, Elie Wiesel. What a heartbreak, right?
Yeah,
I mean, Holocaust survivor, fought like the Dickens, you know, that people wouldn't forget and to understand what this was all about. In the wake of that, Mr. Trump puts this tweet out with this image that, you know, looked to me like that six-star Jewish patch on the clothing of the Holocaust, you know, people. It just made me crazy. I don't understand this. I don't understand how this is happening. I mean, his son-in-law is Jared Kushner.
Everybody says but he's still listening to that base over there, that miserably racist base that he doesn't want to lose. And probably Jared Kushner doesn't want to lose it either. He's pragmatic.
I do not in any way think that Donald Trump is an anti-Semite. And I don't really believe that these people have measured the hardcore anti-Semitic white supremacist base and decided to cultivate it. I don't believe that at all. It is true that some of those people, some people that we would all despise, like Trump. But it's also true that the Palestinians and, you know, all sorts of people who want to get rid of Israel like Hillary. So we don't blame that on her. You can't help all the people you attract. I do think that the campaign has to be more serious about this because it's just been said too many times it's costing them. They need to come out and say something straight about, no, you know, this is not our intention. Nothing we say means that. If we're careless, we're sorry.
Tapala, talk.
Well, one of the employees at the New York Observer wrote a terrific letter today.
Explain who the New York Observer is.
The New York Observer is owned by Jared Kushner's publishing company. You know, Ivanka's husband not only owns a great deal of real estate, it's a major real estate family, like, you know, there's Trumps, there's Kushner's, there's Durst's, but he also owns the New York Observer, the weekly newspaper. I'm sorry, I think we're every day now. But anyway, he, you know, somebody wrote to him, I'm an entertainment writer here, and, you know, this is awful, and you've got to, you can't just stand next to your father-in-law and nod. You can't just ignore what's being said and put out there that is obviously anti-Semitic. I thought good for this woman. Let's see if she has a job next
year. Yeah, we all feel good for her. Yeah,
yeah. Right. And did we explain that Jared Kushner is Jewish and that Ivanka, the daughter, converted to Judaism? They are
Orthodox Jews.
Right. They are observant Jews, no less. What is he thinking when he sees that tweet?
He's not thinking. And I agree with Lisa Schifrin. I don't think Trump's an anti-Semite.
I don't think any of us do.
I don't think that's the point.
I don't think that's the point.
It isn't the point. The point is that he's playing to something that he shouldn't be.
Right. And that's you're guilty, you know, even if you're in your heart or not. But I think so much of Trump is different than, you know, he's obviously not pro-life.
Right.
I mean, come on. And, you know, Maureen Dowd got close to this where she asked him, do you know anyone who's had an abortion? Brilliant question. She let him punt, or she punted by not following up and making him answer the question. But, you know, he spent most of his life around supermodels and beauty pageant contestants. You bet, you know, he knows somebody who had an abortion. Great question to ask him. But this is all, you know, what's so sinful is the throwing the red meat to the face, you know. And ugly, ugly, ugly red meat.
Couldn't agree more.
Agree with you. Great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're not going to believe this, but we're at the end of our half hour. Can you stand it? So let's close it out. Hate to do it, but guys, it's just when it goes this fast, we got to keep on doing it. So here's the deal. Tell me something I don't know, Lisa DiPaolo, or I should know, or you want me to know.
No, absolutely. Let me tell you something. I live on the river in Long Island City on the East River. Boy, was I blown away last night by the security around here. They cleared blocks and blocks of streets of cars. They took the garbage cans off the cars. It's kind of scary. You know, we are, whatever happened to the 4th of July? Anyway, that's my thought. And it was, you know, it was a police state last night. Although, there is an upside to that. These cops are hot.
Yep. Can I be the next person? Because my dovetails into Lisa's. What I heard that you don't know is from somebody very high up in a national security analyst is that ISIS has something big planned for us.
Yes.
So that may be why all those cops, okay? I wrote something recently, it was published. I couldn't put that in. She didn't want me to, but that's what I heard. So, you know,
yikes.
Fingers crossed that isn't true, okay?
Okay. Schifrin, anything?
not on that order, but I will say I too was disappointed last night in all of what went on around the Independence Day celebrations here in New York. Specifically, we had this massive thunderstorm. Otherwise, I would have been able to see the fireworks from north of where they were, where they were being set up. Meanwhile, I was watching it on TV, and it turned out that it had all been pre-taped a week ago.
Isn't that bizarre, PBS?
It was a totally different weather.
Oh, my God.
Like 1 mile due south of me, these girls are dancing in skimpy costumes and it's not raining, but it was pouring.
I don't know what that was with PBS, and boy, they had egg on their face big time today when that story finally came out that that's what happened. So,
but also the Macy's.
Did they do the same thing?
Same thing.
You're kidding. I didn't know that.
It was recorded last week.
So I wonder about that, if that's because of something that they feared. I you know, bizarre, bizarre, bizarre. Okay, it's my turn, right?
Your turn.
Here's my turn. Best show on radio right now. For broad talking on the Hallie Kasser-Jane show. Tell all your friends about it. Let's not be shy. Spread it on Facebook. Spread it on Twitter. You don't even know what we're going to bring you in the next few weeks. So come on back. Ladies, thank you.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun, ladies. We all were very civilized while we disagreed.
Yes, we are.
We are civilized.
We're ladies.
We're ladies and we're broads and we're civilized.
Yes.
All right. Good night, broads.
Good night. Thanks, Hallie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rizal Jazz. Visit HallieKasserJane.com.